Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Breaking news out of Venezuela. U.S.-backed Juan Guaido, the man who declared himself president of Venezuela, although unelected, has been joined by a small group of Venezuelan military defectors and have announced that today's action, backed by the United States, is the beginning of the end of the Maduro government. Joining him is Leopoldo López, who apparently was freed by forces loyal to Guaido. We are joined by journalist Paul Dobson, who is on the ground in Caracas, Venezuela. And more breaking news. Gunshots were fired at the U.S. Embassy in Haiti. This just days after I was in Haiti as part of a delegation led by Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Danny Glover, and attorneys Walter Riley and Brian Concanon, who were also part of the delegation. Today, we bring you the latest update from Haiti, including testimony from women survivors of the politically and motivated and government-backed massacres taking place in La Saline and the surrounding areas in Haiti's capital city of Port-au-Prince. And on the white supremacist attack on the Chabad of Poway Synagogue on April 28th that killed one person and wounded others, we speak with Dustin Crown, Executive Director of the Council of American-Islamic Relations, San Diego, and we mourn the death of famed Black film director John Singleton. We speak with Lawrence Ware, co-director of the Center for Africana Studies and professor of philosophy at Oklahoma State University. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Eileen Alfandari. A tense situation in Venezuela as the country's information minister says that President Nicolas Maduro's government is confronting what he calls a small coup attempt led by military traitors backed by right-wing opponents. Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido took to the streets with a small contingent of heavily armed soldiers and detained activist Leopoldo López at an airbase near the capital, Caracas. López had been under house arrest for leading an anti-government push in 2014. He said in a video he was freed by the military and called on other opponents to join an uprising against the Maduro government.
What is happening in the capital today? All Venezuelans who want freedom should come here, disrupt order, join and encourage our soldiers, join our people. Good morning, Venezuela. Let's do this together.
Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio urged other members of the Venezuelan security forces and the people to take to the streets to support Guaido, who has named himself president. Venezuela's defense minister rejected the coup attempt. Bolivia's president urged Latin American governments to condemn it and blame the U.S. for provoking violence and death in Venezuela. A packed Southern California congregation remembered 60-year-old Lori Kay shot to death in a synagogue this past weekend in Poway. Authorities charged 19-year-old John Ertis with murder and three counts of attempted murder in the weekend attack, which also injured the rabbi, an 8-year-old girl, and her uncle. California Governor Gavin Newsom joined with state lawmakers to pledge solidarity, funding to bolster security, and to take aim at the divisive rhetoric of President Trump. Christopher Martinez reports.
Senator Ben Allen is chair of the Legislative Jewish Caucus.
That dark fire that led our people to the end of those tracks in Auschwitz into the gas chambers still continues to flicker today in our beautiful cities, Charlottesville, Pittsburgh, and now Poway. But let's be clear, we're not in this alone.
Allen was joined by members of the Black Caucus, LGBT Caucus, Women's Caucus, and other lawmakers, as well as Governor Gavin Newsom.
Anti-Semitism is on the rise. To be fair, it was on the rise before Trump took the oath of office, but they have accelerated. hate has been weaponized.
The Anti-Defamation League says anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. have increased 57% over the last year. Senator Hannah Beth Jackson took veiled aim at the president as she noted that hate is growing greater in this country and in this world.
And you know, they say that the fish rots from the head.
I'm Christopher Martinez.
Federal prosecutors announced the arrest of a 26-year-old Army veteran who had converted to Islam and discussed launching various attacks throughout Southern California. U.S. Attorney Nick Hanna said Afghan war veteran Mark Domingo was arrested as he plotted to bomb a white supremacist rally as retribution for the New Zealand mosque attack.
Mr. Domingo had requested the construction of improvised explosive devices, which he planned to use in the attack. He allegedly purchased several hundred 3-inch long nails to be used in IEDs as shrapnel, specifically because the nails were long enough to penetrate the human body and puncture internal organs.
The U.S. attorney said Domingo also discussed other possible attacks targeting Jews walking to synagogue or churches or police officers or a military base or the Santa Monica Pier. Medicare for All gets its first congressional hearing ever this morning before the House Rules Committee. On Friday, House Rules Committee Chair Jim McGovern announced he was adding a Medicare for All activist to the witness list. Author and advocate Andy Barkin was diagnosed with ALS 3 years ago. He's an organizer with the Center for Popular Democracy. At a rally on the eve of this morning's hearing, Barkin addressed the rally. He can no longer speak, so another member of the Center for Popular Democracy read Barkin's remarks.
Healthcare is a human right.
Healthcare is a human right.
I believe that we will win.
I believe that we will win.
Before the addition of Barkin's testimony, Medicare for All advocates were warning the hearing could turn out to be a farce without a strong advocate. In the run-up to the hearing, nurses and other Medicare for All supporters printed out copies of GoFundMe pages of people trying to raise money to pay for medical procedures or expensive drugs. They taped those GoFundMe pages to the headquarters of the pharmaceutical industry's top lobbying group. In his latest crackdown on asylum seekers, President Trump says they should be charged a fee to process their applications. It wasn't clear how much applicants might be forced to pay or how families fleeing poverty and violence would be able to afford such a payment. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, back in studio, slightly with a sore throat, but here, back from my trip on the ground in Haiti. You'll be hearing a lot more about that. But right now, we have breaking news going on in Venezuela. And let us go now to a clip from CNN.
The man leading the charge to topple Nicolas Maduro from power says this is the beginning of the end of Maduro's reign. Juan Guaido says he now has members of the nation's military on his side. His team says there are military uprisings throughout the country, and he's asking the Venezuelan people to stand with him.
Hoy, valientes soldados.
Today, brave soldiers, brave patriots, brave men loyal to the Constitution have heard our call. We have finally met on the streets of Venezuela. Operation Liberty, the Help and Freedom Committees, I invite them to activate immediately. I invite them to immediately cover the streets of Venezuela. The 1st of May has started today. The definitive end to the usurpation has started today.
Well, a spokesman for President Nicolas Maduro says the situation is under control. Let's get the view live from the Venezuelan capital. Journalist Stefano Pozobon is in Caracas and joins us now. Stefano, describe the scene for us.
Yes, Anna, and I'm talking to you just meters away from the key military base here in central Caracas, where in the early hours of today, we have seen footage from opposition leaders Juan Guaido and Leopoldo López. Why is his presence is key? Because Leopoldo López is a former opposition leader who has been under house arrest for and in jail for the past 5 years. Seeing him here means that at least his captors, or somehow he was able to evade his captors and evade security. Right now, the situation in central Caracas is extremely, extremely tense. We're speaking to you with tear gas growing in the highway that cuts through Caracas. And we're seeing also the presence and of some members of the military forces, in this case, a few tens of National Guardsmen joining sides with the civilian opposition have gathered here to claim and to demand the resignation of Embattled President Nicolas Maduro. So definitely it's not just a civilian opposition onto the street, but the military as well, or some parts of the military as well.
All righty, there we go. I'd like to welcome a man who is on the ground in Venezuela, Paul Dobson, who is a journalist with Venezuela Analysis. Paul, welcome back.
Hi there, Margaret.
Okay, so Paul, you likely missed, we just heard a clip from CNN giving us some background here, including Juan Guaido's call for this, what he's calling the final phase of Operation Liberty. And he's claiming that there are military uprisings going on across Venezuela. What do you know about all this?
Well, at the moment, Margaret, and I can't confirm this information. The information that we have received at Venezuela Analysis is quite the contrary, that the rest of the country is in a state of perfect calm. There are opposition supporters, civilians, taking to the streets to support Juan Guaido's efforts. There are also pro-government supporters, Chavistas, doing the same thing. But in terms of military uprisings, there's not been a single report here in Venezuela other than the handful of military men in Caracas who rose up this morning in the Carlota Air Base.
Yeah, and clearly, Leopoldo López, he was under house arrest. So they were clearly able to free him from house arrest, where he has been for the past 5 years. So there does seem to be an internal operation going on here, and of course with the full backing and support of the United States. Do we know anything about who these military forces are? How widespread is it? What is the size of these? What's described as by AP? They're saying that it's a small contingent of heavily armed soldiers, right? And is that the report you're getting, that it's a small contingent, but they are heavily armed?
Exactly. The information we have at the moment is that this seems to be no more than a handful. There are also police elements involved as well. A few of them seem to be policemen who assisted in the freeing of Leopoldo López from house arrest. But it really doesn't seem to be anything more than that. The opposition and Juan Guaido have obviously taken advantage of this to depict an image in Venezuela of the armed forces rising up on a much more general level, which I think is important we need to debunk to some extent.
Yeah, and the Associated Press, they're also reporting that there are a crowd of just a few hundred people who are Guaido supporters who are close to the Carlota Air Base in Caracas, I'm assuming where that is. And that tear gas was fired from inside the Carlota Air Base. So, you know, he's connecting this to May Day, and he's calling for people in the masses, and I suppose that means in the hundreds of thousands, to turn out in a protest of Maduro. And that protest was scheduled to begin tomorrow, is that right? Or was that protest scheduled for today, as far as you know?
No, that was definitely scheduled for tomorrow. Tomorrow, both the pro-government and anti-government forces were organizing rallies. Over the last few weeks, we've seen Guaido return ever-decreasing size of convocation of people. His rallies are smaller every time. So it seems that what he is doing today, this, to some extent, media circus could be with a handful of military men, is very much stoking the fire for what is planned tomorrow to be a demonstration to try and oust the government. Now, obviously, the pro-government forces, the Chavistas, are responding to this. The presidential palace at the moment is currently surrounded by the Chavista forces in Caracas, who have taken to the streets as well, to not just protect their president, but also to protect the democratic and constitutional order in the country. And we can expect tomorrow's May Day march to be of a very large scale from both sides of the political divide.
Right. Well, we're going to continue to watch this. It's being reported that the defense minister has rejected what he called an attempt by a subversive movement to generate panic and terror. And they're saying that supporters of the Bolivarian Revolution, of Nicolas Maduro, will be going to Miraflores, which is the presidential palace, they say, to defend the revolution. Now, I'm not quite sure, just your final thoughts here on what is expected, because we know very well that there is strong support for the Maduro government on the ground. And if there's any attempt to oust him or to do this kind of action as they're attempting to do today, this could end up in a bloodbath. And one also has to wonder about whether the United States would then use this as an opportunity for military intervention, and that what that might mean, what kind of response that might get. And recalling that people in the United States in Washington, D.C. right now are occupying the Venezuelan embassy there to protect the embassy from being taken over by Juan Guaido supporters. Just your final thoughts, Paul.
Well, I think this is definitely a scenario which is being analyzed in the closed offices of the Pentagon and of the State Department in the United States. Obviously, any large-scale outbreak of violence, as we saw in 2002, in fact, with the coup d'etat, makes for a very good cover for any sort of regime change escalation. So I think that the world should be alert to this, without a doubt. The government have called for peace. Numerous other governments in the region, including Argentina, including Spain as well, in Europe, have called for peace in this conflict today. And I think the actions or the decisions taken by Juan Guaido are going to be very important in determining whether this ends up in a bloodbath or not.
Absolutely. And we know that the United States has been making moves in the OAS, the Organization of American States, for a very strongly worded resolution against the Maduro government. And that resolution, basically, as far as I have heard, I just came back from Haiti, so maybe I missed it. But as far as I know, that has continued to be blocked, in particular by the CARICOM, the Caribbean island nations. So we'll see how all of this breaks out, and we will have you back and follow this very, very carefully. Paul Dobson, journalist with Venezuela Analysis, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Margaret.
Okay, now we are going to turn our attention to the white supremacist attack that happened over the weekend on a Shabbat. This is on the final day of Passover of Poway Synagogue on April 28th, that killed one person, wounded others, and, you know, just a terrible situation there. We also learned that the person who did this attack, and they're pretty sure, authorities are pretty sure that this is the person who did it, also said that he was the person who also set fire to a synagogue close to San Diego not that long ago. And we are waiting now to speak with Dustin Crown, the executive director of the Council of Islamic Relations in San Diego. He is a community organizer, a writer. He's written on race, philosophy, and Islamic studies that have been published in a number of academic journals and popular publications. And he is now on the line with us. I'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth, Dustin Crown. Dustin, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, so Dustin, I mean, as this news broke of this attack by a white supremacist, really, and the news on the Shabbat, on the last day of Passover, one of the most holy days for people of the Jewish faith, I recalled speaking to somebody from the Council of American Islamic Relations not that long ago when a fire was set against a mosque that was also in the greater San Diego area. And now we find that this man has confessed to having set that fire. But meanwhile, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has yet again been under attack by conservatives, including Liz Cheney and others, that fundamentally blamed her for the attack. Just your response to the attack and also your response to these renewed attacks against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar.
I think it's really important that we start with an understanding of white supremacy and the history of white supremacy in this country and what it's meant for communities of color and what and how it's been used by power to hold on to power throughout the history of the United States, and the way that things are always framed where white people are seen as benevolent, as the givers of civilization, the givers of government, the givers of free speech, and at the same time innocent. And this allows, and this is the framing the Trump administration uses with their own identity politics over and over and over again, and the right wing that supports them. While at the same time, there's realities of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism that are specific to these communities, and we have to understand them specifically, how they're used against Muslim communities, how they're used against Jewish communities. And then there's this overlap with someone like this, who attacks both a mosque and a synagogue. And so understanding that at this point, you know, people of faith have to have solidarity as much as is possible, understanding that all of our congregations are under attack by white supremacists. And then as it relates to Congresswoman Omar, it just, you know, again, these are people who are creating a conversation, taking things completely out of context, like the speech, the conversation they were having about remarks about 9/11 that literally had nothing to do with even what she was saying. It just shows how far they will stretch words that we speak to create their own, to use their own political agenda. I mean, Congresswoman Omar started really important conversations about the U.S. government's support of Israel and the endless human rights abuses in the apartheid regime within Israel.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm looking at a report here that says as the shooting unfolded, that extremists gathered on Facebook, on the Facebook page connected to the gunman. So despite, you know, what we're being told about Facebook and these dangerous accounts, really, they're still up there. They're saying that 22 of the first 25 accounts that posted praise on the suspect, who is a 19-year-old, a white 19-year-old, remain active on Facebook as of Monday, right? And this shooting happened on Saturday. And also, you know, a lot of people may not know this, but the New York Times is reporting that California has more organized hate groups than any other state. Now, that may very well be the case, because in the next part of that sentence, they include Black nationalists in that. I mean, I don't know how they could put in Black nationalists along with white supremacists, you know, and clump them all together as hate groups. But a lot of people, though, do see California as this haven of progressive politics and, you know, multiracial ism, et cetera, et cetera. But they are really dug in Southern California and also Northern California, these hate and white supremacist groups. I'm sure this is something you all in the Council of American Islamic Relations are very aware of, given the rise of Islamophobic attacks, for example.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've lived in Northern California and now I live in Southern California, and I'm the executive director of the CARE chapter here in San Diego. And you definitely see the difference within the cultural realities of white supremacy being very present within Southern California, within Orange County, within San Diego County. But, you know, I think a really good way to explain what's happening, even the social media platforms as an example, throughout the last 20 years after 9/11, there's been all these programs called Countering Violent Extremism, looking at countering Muslim extremism. And, you know, some of these programs, a lot of these programs were used to spy on Muslim communities. But even they had these programs at technology companies. They created algorithms to seek out extremist Muslim groups. But yet we don't see, even though the FBI has said repeatedly that white supremacist violence is the greatest threat in this country, we don't see the same response from the technology community to white supremacists. We don't see the same response from police departments and from the FBI to white supremacist violence. And so it's just really surprising that to see the stark differences. And if this is such a serious problem, how do we root this out? How do we shut down hate speech groups online? Because as I was just reading the report about this 19-year-old man, that this was a period of 18 months that he was radicalized. It happened very quickly, and it happened all online, and it happened all in these hate groups. And so if we can't stop hate speech, then this will continue to grow.
Yeah, and I mean, Donald Trump, I mean, after the attacks in New Zealand that killed so many people, injured so many others, Donald Trump said, well, you know, this, you know, it's not really a big problem. This is just a small group of very sick people. So this thing about, you know, a small group, you know, we all know that that's not the case. I mean, we do see a rise of these white nationalists, white supremacists, Nazi-leaning groups, not only here in the United States, but you see them in Europe as well. And the issue of race and racism is so obvious in it, but it does seem to be an uptick with the election of Donald Trump. And here in the show, we actually refer to him as the global white supremacist in chief, because he seems to be, an inspiration for a lot of these guys. And it's not true that these are just lone wolves. They are part of a whole dangerous network of people. In many reports by the Southern Poverty Law Center and others. Just some final thoughts from you.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that he's empowering these people. He's giving them the language to come together. He's giving he's creating a political movement that allows them to come together to take up arms, literally. And so we have to understand that this has to do with the president. It has to do with all of our communities. But at the same time, we see really positive things happening also, where our communities are coming together and we're praying. You know, this week we're praying, we're protesting, we're getting to know each other in ways we haven't previously. This weekend on the U.S.-Mexico border, we had a prayer in Tijuana, and on the U.S. side at Friendship Park, where there was a group of Christians on one side, a group of Muslims and Christians on the other side, and we called it a prayer beyond borders, where we're praying for an end to this violence. We're praying for an end to this manufactured crisis at the border by President Trump. And we have to understand how this issue at the border, these issues of white supremacy, these issues led by President Trump are all connected. And so you're right, the white supremacist in chief is the primary problem. We have to understand how we're going to fight that in 2020. And I think the other thing I want to add is that we really have to, related to Islamophobia, we have to get localized and say and name names. Who are the worst Islamophobes in a place like San Diego? How do we vote them? How do we vote them out? How do we take them out of power? How do we remove them from media publications? How do we defund their programming through advertising campaigns to remove their advertisers? We have to get really strategic how we remove these things.
Yeah, and just quick, finally, I mean, you see Benjamin Netanyahu, who just won re-election in Israel, who is referred to Palestinians and other Arabs as wild beasts. And they always talk about civilized societies. You wonder who the heck they're talking about. And that he is also didn't use the word terrorist in describing the attack. And he stays with saying that it was an attack against that it was an anti-Semitic attack. But how then do you explain the fact that this guy allegedly also said that he tried to burn down a mosque? Do you know what I mean? It's just that kind of double standard. And also that even when Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and was grieving for what happened at the Chabad and issued a statement of sympathy, she was attacked for that.
Right, and she represents all the intersections of identity that white supremacists want to fight against. You know, she's a black woman, she wears the hijab, she's a Muslim, she's a refugee, she's an immigrant, right? And so it's not surprising the level of hate that she receives, and that's why we, as you know, progressives, have to support her in every way possible, continue to send money to her campaigns and make sure that her voice stays in the walls of Congress so we have representatives like that. You know, and one last thing I'll add is another example of the way these stark differences between how even entities like the FBI are handling them. Yesterday there was another manufactured terrorism case in Los Angeles where this 26-year-old former military converts to Islam, and the FBI starts recruiting them on this terrorism plot. Gives him fake bombs. Gives him these things. They recruit amongst the Muslims to create fake terror plots, and then at the same time, do you see the FBI, infiltrating white supremacist organizations? But yet they've been infiltrating mosques and Muslim organizations for the last 18 years, what Trevor Arison calls the largest COINTELPRO program in the history of the United States. And so clearly this is still happening, and it shows the stark differences between how white supremacy is being handled and how, Muslim extremism has been handled by the FBI.
Right. Well, on that note, we are going to have to leave it there. And I imagine people could go to the CARE website, CARE LA or CARE San Diego website, to find out more about your work in these really difficult times. You're up against so much. We so very much appreciate you joining us, Dustin Crown, is it? Crown, of the executive director of CARE San Diego. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and God bless.
We are going to take a short station break. And the song that we're going to be doing during our station break, a lot of mourning going on. Coming up very shortly, we'll be doing a segment on John Singleton, the famed black film director of Boys in the Hood and so many others, who has now died, has passed away. And so we will be honoring John Singleton. But we also cannot forget Lori Kay, the 60-year-old woman and employee of the Chabad, who was killed in that white supremacist attack.
Hey, LA, this is Stephanie Miller. Join me for news updates, snappy political satire, and commentary on all the crazy. Start your day with the Stephanie Miller Show at 6 a.m. on 90.7 KPFK and kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Gloria Steinem.
This is Joni Mitchell.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
And we're now going to hear, as in the tradition of Sojourner Truth, the mourning song sung in Dida from the Ivory Coast by the album Na Afriki.
Ao pepe kukolo yangoko ngala yangoko aiye o kolo kalo ao kolo kalo
And in honor of John Singleton and as well as Lori Kay, the woman who was killed in white supremacist attack, in Poway, California. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 90 days after that, just from today, 10 this morning and 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And you could also hear us on our website. Just go to sotrueradio.org and you can check out all of the news that we have there as well. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And we're also on SoundCloud, and you can just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Atlanta, Georgia. People in Atlanta are asking who killed all those missing children. Remember those missing black children some years ago that happened in Atlanta? Remains a mystery. And internationally, I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the world's first black republic in the island nation of Haiti. And our handle on Twitter and Instagram is at So True Radio. We are now going to turn our attention to the latest on what's happening in Haiti. There's breaking news coming out of there. I'm back in studio today, just finishing up my second trip this month, emergency trip to Haiti, where the greatest human rights violations and disaster in the whole of the Americas is happening right now, with a series of massacres, politically targeted massacres, backed by the corrupt government of Jovenel Moïse. Jovenel Moïse, supported by the United States, and I believe, and many say, installed by the United States, because the election was that held, the last presidential election was really a selection. There was so much fraud in that election to basically keep Lavalas, which is the party of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, out of power. Dr. Maryse Narcisse was the candidate and rightfully should be the president of Haiti right now. Haiti, since that election, there's been protest after protest after protest. Moïse government and his colleague, Martelly, the president before him, also backed by the United States, close to $3 billion of Petro-Caribe money have disappeared, have just walked away. People in Haiti are demanding accountability. And then you have these brutal massacres where people are cut up, their bodies are burned, houses are burned down, and specifically the areas they're targeting are areas of stronghold of Lavalas, the party of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. In fact, it is La Saline is the place where the movement of Lavalas began, the church where Jean-Bertrand Aristide was the priest. He was a Catholic priest, is based there. And they've got a history, a long history of resistance. And now they are being politically targeted to try to squell the protests that began in La Saline and spread across Haiti. Today, we're going to hear some testimony from some women I met with just a few days ago on the ground in Haiti, just describing what happened to them.
Samedi, qui était 13 avril 2019, là, des gros massacres qui étaient passés.
On Saturday, like April 19th, there was a massacre occurred in the neighborhoods of like Tokyo, La Saline, and Cité Vincent.
Côté en plein monde, des mouris, caloulés, on trouvait tête monde, voyez dans la jet, si monde prend balle, grand monde mourit. Côté moi-même, moi j'ai deux petites filles.
That day, many people died, people were decapitated, people lost like their homes as they were burned and ransacked. And myself, I have like two daughters, and I am like the father and the mother for these two daughters.
Nan la ri a de timon, se zanmi, ki ka fem kado de general,
Just had like the payment for my yearly rent for my home. So when they came and burned my house, it's like now I have nothing. Now I rely on people, neighbors, like to provide clothing to me, to provide food to me. And I have like these two kids and I am homeless. I'm in the street and the dust is very hard on us. The rain is very hard on us. So if you see like the body of the kids, it washes like all over. So this is a very critical situation for our family.
Comment c'est boulé en haut, rivé juste en bas. Ça veut dire qu'il y a fini avec ni mon Tokyo, ni mon Nassaline, ni mon cité Vincent.
They started the burning all the way from like the lower part of the neighborhood to the upper part of the neighborhood.
What is the name of the neighborhood?
Alors, c'est, she would like mention. So they saying that they want to get rid of all the people from these three different neighborhoods, Tokyo, La Saline, and City Vincent, like a Vincent city. Now, all the kids from this neighborhood are homeless. They don't even have like their uniforms, so there's no way that they can go to school. And if you see them in the street, you can see they look like children who never had like a family taking care of them, and this is a real critical situation. I can only call for justice for the country, for the people who lose like everything. And as I know, there is a president like in the country who is really the one like paying like squads and groups to attack the people of the country. All that I can say to him is thank you. If it's what he believes that we deserve, I can only tell him like thank you for what he is doing to the people of this country. But I know that like we will find justice and we call for justice for the people of these neighborhoods.
All righty. And we're going to have to stop it there, but there's a lot more. I spoke to so many people, came and gave testimony to Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who pledged to take the information back to her colleagues in Washington. This is a U.S.-backed government. And sadly, we couldn't play more today, but we will continue to bring you voices of these survivors. And you heard her refer to Tokyo and Cité Saint-Vincent. Tokyo and Cité Saint-Vincent are already part of the greater La Saline area. One is just really right across the street from each other. So just tragedy there. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And now we are going to turn our attention to the sad news of the death of John Singleton, only 51 years old. Became famous at a very, very young age when he did the film Boys in the Hood. Let's go to a short clip now from the New York Times about John Singleton.
The man behind this iconic 1991 film has died. The director, John Singleton, was 51 years old. His family took him off life support after he had a stroke earlier this month. He's best known as the director and screenwriter of Boys in the Hood, a coming-of-age story of three black teenagers in South Central Los Angeles.
Wait a minute, hey, man, it's family business.
The film earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Director, becoming the first African-American nominee, as well as the youngest, in that category. He was also nominated for Best Original Screenplay. His hometown of Los Angeles featured prominently in many of his films.
You know, in film school, they always teach you, write about what you know. And I was like, wow, you know, this is what I know, this is where I'm from, so I can do something different. I can make something that is really about where we're from in South Central Los Angeles.
Singleton took an early interest in film during his younger years.
My mother used to take my little rolls of film to the lab and get them made for me, developed for me when in high school. So I wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't for my mother.
Growing up, he was influenced by Coolie High and Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It. After Boys in the Hood, he would go on to direct in a variety of genres. He went on to inspire and mentor many African-American filmmakers and actors.
All right, there you go. I'd like to now welcome our guest, Lawrence Ware, co-director of the Center for Africana Studies and a professor of philosophy at Oklahoma State University. Dr. Ware, thank you for joining us. I'm not hearing Dr. Ware. Let's make sure that he's there. He also is a contributing writer to the New York Times and also to Slate magazine. Dr. Ware, can you hear me?
I'm here.
Okay, very good. I can hear you now. And so very sad news here. Very young, 51 years old, John Singleton. Tell us from your perspective of the impact that he has had, his greater impact, not only in Hollywood, but just generally, particularly in Black communities, but across the country.
Really, John Singleton was kind of foundational for taking a West Coast kind of LA-based kind of storytelling and telling that story in a way that is approachable to audiences from places as far as New York City and even somewhere, a little small town in Oklahoma, and making it something that we all can resonate with. So when you look at something like Boys in the Hood, which came out in 1991, you know, that was a film that let you know that this is a person to be reckoned with. And he was the youngest filmmaker to be directed for, I mean, to be nominated for Academy Award in directing. He was the first Black filmmaker, you know, believe it or not, even though Spike Lee had already made Do the Right Thing and whatnot. He was the first Black director to be nominated. So this was really the beginning of the new wave of Black filmmakers. Spike Lee had already kind of set the stage with Do the Right Thing and with School Days and whatnot come before. But John Singleton was a person who kind of took things in a new direction, really grounded it in an urban kind of realism and set the stage for things like Menace to Society, which came thereafter, and of course Poetic Justice, really kind of telling an urban story centered in the Black community, but even more so grounding it in the human experience where we're all able to kind of relate and appreciate what he's up to.
Yeah, one of the things that the actor Angela Bassett has said, she really credited Singleton for, you know, giving her, of course, she was in that film, that famous film,
right,
for really giving her
right
a start, because she said she had been on television and people were branding her as like a TV actress, right? Mm-hmm. But it was really Singleton who recognized that her talent and really gave her that breakthrough. So I imagine that there's so many others following Angela Bassett who have benefited from the work of John Singleton.
You know, Ice Cube, for example, is a person, I believe his first starring role was in Boys in the Hood. He was a doughboy in that film. Mm. And he really showed us something with his acting. And so now Ice Cube is it's a household name. He has the barbershop films. He has the ride-along films. And so John Singleton, along with Spike Lee and other Black filmmakers, was really instrumental in taking these, you know, I like to call them like household Black names, right? You know, these names that we know of, you know, because of us watching 227 or us watching, you know, stuff that's kind of centered in the Black experience, and bringing them to the mainstream so that now other people are paying attention to them. And now Angela Bassett is everywhere, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now Regina King just recently won the Academy Award. And so those are people who kind of got their start in these Black films, but they then went to higher heights because of people like John Singleton.
Yeah, and it's interesting that since then, no Black filmmaker has won the Oscar for Best Director. I mean, John lost to Silence of the Lambs, right? Jonathan Demme film. And of course, Spike Lee this year, he won for Best Adapted Screenplay. He didn't.
But not Best Director.
Not Best Director. So there you go. You know, Professor where I also wanted you to talk a little bit about the context of the work of John Singleton, because, you know, there was a lot going on. I mean, he's from South Los Angeles, and the film Boys in the Hood about South Los Angeles, and a lot was going on at the time in the lead up to South Los Angeles. You had the whole crack cocaine scandal of, you know, reports of CIA military planes bringing in crack cocaine into South LA. And it was South LA where crack cocaine was first introduced into the United States and then spread. You have that going on. You have the COINTELPRO operation that had happened against the militant Black movement, the Black Panther Party and others. Absolutely. And you have Black youth kind of flailing around, you know, in terms of where to put, you know, energy. You have the serial murders of Black women going on. Absolutely. At this time that I've been very, very involved in. So just tell us then, just within that context, the significance then of John Singleton's work, in particular that breakout film, but the work he's done since then.
Well, and also about a year after Boys in the Hood came out, around, I want to say about a year or so after, then the L.A. riots happened, starting in April and ending in May. So, you know, John Singleton, that first film that he released, Boys in the Hood, is right there in that almost kind of sweet spot, if you will, of all these tensions happening around. You have all the things that you've mentioned. You have the L.A. riots that are kind of bubbling up. And so you have him releasing this film that is essentially a coming-of-age film, right? You know, these are films that have been around for a long, long time. And they've been books written about them. Mark Twain wrote a book. Huckleberry Finn is a coming-of-age story. But what's unique about what he's doing is he centers it in the Black experience. And he centers it in what it feels like to be a Black person on the underside of the American Democratic experience. And you have Doughboy, who is this gangster kind of figure. You have Morris Chestnut's figure, who is a sports figure. And then you have Cuba Gooding Jr., who's right there in the middle. And it centers it in this experience, but then it kind of spins out away from it, because you begin to see, when you have Lawrence Fishburne talking about the role of capitalism in the Black community, and the way that you have these liquor stores on street corners, you have COINTELPRO. He talks about these kind of things. So it's surrounding the film, and it comes up briefly, but the film is really about the experience of these young boys. And then from there, he goes on to make things like Poetic Justice, which stars Tupac Shakur, and I really think a really underappreciated performance by Janet Jackson.
Yeah.
And then you go on, you have Higher Learning, and now he's taking his focus away from this urban experience, because Poetic Justice is still a very urban story, and now he's applying it to a predominantly white institution, a fictional school, but a predominantly white institution, which is a very volatile film. Higher Learning shook me when I saw it in the movie theaters. I don't know if I might not have gotten over it still. Like, it shook me the way that film ends. Mm. But really, I think his magnum opus, his best film, to my mind, is Rosewood, which came in 1997, and that tells the story of a Black town that was destroyed. So John Singleton, he starts in the urban area, but then he kind of broadens his horizons and begins to talk about Higher Learning and talk about what it feels like to be a Black person surrounded by white folks. And then he kind of goes even further and goes into a historical realm, but still kind of centers it in the Black experience. John Singleton was a filmmaker to kind of reckon with, and it's really sad that his work never really reached those heights again. Mm-hmm. But what he gave us was, without a question, something worthy of examining.
Yeah, that Rosewood story, my daughter over the last couple of days just told me how much she appreciated me taking her to see Rosewood when she was young. You know, the impact that this has. And also, we have to wrap up in about a minute or so, but he was still working on Snowfall, which was going to be a series on FX. About, again, this crack cocaine thing, huh?
Yeah, it's a show that's already out. It came out, so it's in its second season, I believe. But yeah, it's a show that kind of centers in the Black experience, and it tells the story of how crack cocaine kind of exploded and became what it was. It was a really interesting series. It was a really good show.
Yeah, and apparently it's still continuing, right? So
yeah,
he has passed on before he was able to see this project through. Well, Professor Dr. Lawrence Ware, we appreciate appreciate you taking the time to join us, even for this very, very sad moment as we mark the death of John Singleton, Black director, dying at the young age of 51. He was at Cedars Sinai Medical Center in Southern California, and his mother, Sheila Ward, had announced, you know, he was in a coma, and the family made the very, very difficult decision of having to basically take him off what was keeping him alive right now. So John Singleton, dead at the age of 51. Thank you, Lawrence Ware.
Thank you.
Okay, we are out of time. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank Jose Benavides, who is sitting in for our assistant producer, Romero Funes. I'd like to thank our engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson. And for our segment on Haiti, I'd like to thank Jackson Fleuron, who is a videographer with Tele Timon, alternative television there in Haiti. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230, or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Of course, we'd like to thank all of today's guests. You're going to stay tuned for Democracy Now! Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.